Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by those lovely people at Cooker. 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. I say lovely people not only because they sponsor the podcast, but because they're a modern thinking company. They look after their staff and they look after their customers too. They certainly fit with my values. I hope I fit with their values also. If you can afford one, I recommend it. My friend who had one installed a couple of months ago texted the other day to confirm that his kettle was going. I think I kept mine for my kettle for a good 6 months, I reckon. It's just one of those things you're so used to that you think, oh, I better keep it just in case. But I've not seen a kettle in my house for years now. For details, go to cooker.co.uk and you can see the range there as well. Right, so today's hour is a big one. I'm curious about how we're losing our lives to tech. It's huge because we are. Well, I am. I think you are too, but we'll find out. I realized the other day that I'm in a pretty privileged position, aren't I? I get to read so many great books, learn so much about life, get to interview these fantastic people who have done research and you know, really looked at the way we are living at the moment. And I thoroughly enjoy it. I hope you lot are enjoying it soon. Coming soon, actually, I have what I think is an exciting project where I'm putting all the knowledge, wisdom that I'm learning from these experts, from these podcasts. I'm going to put it all in one place so you can read it and so you can discuss it, hopefully with me, and we can ask more questions. We can navigate through our lives. I hope you think that's a good idea, because I do. I keep looking back at some of my old podcasts thinking, Christ, I've forgotten all about that. And, you know, it's hard to keep on top of it all, but some really good stuff. Anyway, this podcast is going to be brilliant. I have a serious mobile phone addiction. I have a tech addiction. I have a Netflix addiction. I mean, all this stuff comes at me and I'm an absolute mess with it all, I know. And I've known it for ages. I've talked about it a lot. I've talked about it on here. I've talked about it on my TV show. I think everyone just laughs at me and goes, oh, what's he talking about? But I genuinely know it's a problem. And my life is worse for it. But I can't work out a way to navigate through a life without having it. And I've tried. Oh, my God, I've tried. But I can't. Yoann Hari has written a book called Stolen Focus, which is all about this. And just how we lack attention. You think it's bad for us. You want to look at our kids. And I've seen that in my kids as well. We're in a bad place. And Yoann knows all about this. And he's written a book about it. Yoann Hari is a journalist. But I don't know what I'd describe him as. More of an anthropologist, really. Modern sort of a cultural anthropologist. Social anthropologist. Anyway, he's written two excellent books. One on depression, one on drugs. They're the ones that I have read and love. They're great books and I recommend them both. This one is fantastic too. Couldn't put him down. Let's meet him and find out how our lives are all broken. It's Yoann Hari. Yoann, thank you very much for joining me today. How are you?
I am good. I'm somewhat tired. I've been in Las Vegas because I've been doing a lot of research for a future book there. And I was just saying before we went on air, Vegas is a really weird place to spend a pandemic. I mean, it's a weird place to spend any amount of time, but it's a particularly weird place to spend a pandemic because you're surrounded by people whose response to a global pandemic is to say, let's go to Vegas. So it's been a bit weird, but good. Really happy, really excited to talk about a book. Thrilled to be back with you. I'm gutted we're not doing this in person, but sadly the prospect of imminent death has kept us apart.
Yeah, I absolutely love your book because it's really hit on something that I've been discussing a lot, and I've been discussing it for a few years now, 3 or 4 years, and I noticed it. The lack of attention happened. I'll just tell you a quick couple of things which happened to me, because then you can see where I got to and then we can discuss it. But I had a back operation and I was told that I had to lie basically pretty much not do much for 2 weeks. And I noticed by the time I got to the end of the 2 weeks that I'd actually worked up a blister on my little finger because I just kept my phone swiping and swiping, wow, and swiping and swiping. I'd got so bored of Netflix. I'd got so bored of everything that I'd literally exhausted myself. Hmm. And then the next thing is I did a psilocybin trial for the Imperial College. I just put myself on it. You know, it wasn't because I was on TV or anything. I just heard about it, and I'd heard about psilocybin, which is magic mushrooms for anyone who doesn't know. And they gave me two doses, and I didn't know what they were. The first dose was a microdose. The second dose was a macrodose. And on the microdose, I just got really bored. And I sat there for 5 hours, just kind of really bored. But what it did do is it made me realize it was so enlightening, because I realized that we don't show anything attention anymore. And I've got two teenage daughters who are 19. And when they were off to university, I wrote one of them a card which said, if you value something, show it attention. Because it really, I realized that I have no attention span anymore. And this is what's happened in the modern world. I pick up your book to read and I go, wow, you're writing about something that I know I'm addicted and I can't break it. So tell me how you got involved in it. How is your attention at the moment?
Yeah, that's there's so many interesting things in what you just said, Tim. I'm just thinking about them because, like you, for a long time, I had this sort of ambient sense that something was wrong, right? And, you know, and I would come across small studies when I was thinking, should I look at this? And there were suggestive small studies. You know, one study of American college students found that the average amount of time they focus on any task is 65 seconds. And a different study found the average office worker now focuses on any one task for 3 minutes. And I would think, Jesus, that's your life dissolving into a sort of hailstorm of 3 minute chunks, right? And I felt like I felt like I could see it happening all around me, see it happening to myself. But there was this moment for me when I thought, oh, you know, I'm going to have to do a really in-depth investigation of this. It's quite a personal thing. So I've got a godson. I'm going to call him Adam. That's not his real name because I don't want to use his real name. And when he was 9, he developed this brief but really freakishly intense obsession with Elvis Presley. You know, the way 9-year-olds get obsessed with things. And he was constantly running around singing Viva Las Vegas and Suspicious Minds. And he didn't know that Elvis style had become like a kind of cheesy cliches. It was actually, he thought he was being cool. It was incredibly cute. And he kept getting me to tell him the story of Elvis's life. So I told him the story. And in passing, I mentioned, obviously, Elvis bought this mansion for his mother and named it Graceland, right? And one night when I was tucking him in, he looked at me very intensely and he said, Johan, will you take me to Graceland one day? And in the way that you make promises to small children, knowing they'll forget it the next day, I was like, sure. And he's like, no, do you really promise? And I'm like, I absolutely promise. And I never thought about it again until 10 years later when lots of things had gone wrong. So he was 19 by then. He dropped out of school when he was 15. And he just seemed to be spending all his time, whenever I saw him, which was a lot, just alternating between his three devices. So he had an iPad, he had a laptop, and he had a phone. And it's like his life had become a blur of WhatsApp and YouTube and porn. And it was like nothing could get any traction in his mind. It was like his head was whirring at the speed of Snapchat, right? And he's a lovely person, but you could really feel like there was something profoundly wrong. And in that decade in which he had become a man, he was at the extreme end of it. But I had seen this happen to so many people, and I'd felt those pressures bearing on myself. Every time I met with, I'm 42 now, every time I met with people my own age, we'd sort of lament our vanishing ability to pay attention, like it was a sort of sailor who'd been lost at sea and not seen since, right? So one afternoon I was sitting on this sofa with him and he was just scrolling and scrolling and scrolling. I was trying to talk to him and I just couldn't get any kind of conversation going that lasted more than a minute. And I suddenly remembered this moment when he'd been a little boy. And I said, you know what? We need to break this routine. Let's go to Graceland. And he was like, he didn't even remember this Elvis obsession, right? I was like, no, we're going to go to Graceland. I'll take you. Let's go all over the American South. But you've got to promise one thing to me, which is that when we go, you'll leave your phone in the hotel during the day. So, because I can't take you around if you're going to just be, you know, on your phone the whole time. And he made this promise. And a couple of weeks later, we took off from Heathrow and we went initially to New Orleans. But so when we got to Graceland, when you arrive at the gates of Graceland now, there isn't a guide to show you around. They hand you an iPad and you put in earphones. And the iPad sort of shows you around. So it says, you know, go left, go right. And in every room you're in, it shows you that room on the iPad and it explains interesting things about that room. So what happens is people walk around Graceland just staring at an iPad, right? And I'm sort of walking around and everyone's sort of just looking down at their iPad. And I'm getting a little bit tense and irritated. And I keep trying to make eye contact with people to go, oh, you know, we're the ones who traveled 3,000 miles and actually looked at the thing in front of us, right? And there was one person who made eye contact with me and I was like, about to say it. And then I realized he'd only taken out the headphones and looked away from the iPad to take out his phone and take a selfie. Anyway, we get to the jungle room, which was Elvis's favorite room in the mansion.
I've been there. It's amazing, isn't it? It's very green.
And it's very green and kind of quite sad. There's these sort of sagging plastic plants, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But
Johan, can I just say, if you're getting a bit too, mic's popping. Can you just?
Oh, I'm sorry. Am I too close to it? Yeah.
Yeah, great. Just a bit too close.
Do you want me to set again? Or
no. It's all great. But
We got to the jungle room and there was this couple standing next to me. I think we're Canadian. And the husband turned to his wife and he said, "Hey, honey, this is amazing. Look, if you swipe left, you can see the jungle room to the left. And if you swipe right, you can see the jungle room to the right." So she starts swiping left and right. And I look at this guy and I said to him, "But sir, there's an old-fashioned form of swiping you could do. You could just turn your head because we're actually in the jungle room. You don't have to look at a digital representation of it. We're actually there. Do you understand? We're in the jungle room." And entirely understandably, these people clearly thought I was a mad person and just sort of backed out of the room. And I turned to my godson to sort of laugh about how crazy this was. And he was just in a corner looking at Snapchat, because from the minute we arrived, he had just been constantly on his phone. And I really snapped at him and I just said, "You know, you're afraid of missing out, but this behavior is guaranteeing you miss out. You're not seeing the things that are right in front of you. You're never present." And I think I shouted. Anyway, he stormed off and I spent the rest of the day wandering around Memphis on my own. And then that night I found it. We were staying in the Heartbreak Hotel, which is just down the street from Graceland. And I found him by the swimming pool, which is shaped like a guitar where they constantly play Suspicious Minds in a loop. And he was just sitting there looking at his phone. And I went up to him and I apologized, because I could see that a lot of my anger towards him was actually anger at these trends in myself. And he just looked at his phone and he said, "I know something's wrong, but I don't know what it is." And that was when I thought, right, I need to look into this. So as you know, for the book, I ended up traveling all over the world, from Moscow to Miami, from a favela in Rio de Janeiro where tension had collapsed in a particularly terrible way, to a town in New Zealand where they'd found a really interesting way to restore attention. And I interviewed the leading experts in the world about attention to try to understand what is happening to us and how do we put it right.
Yeah, interesting you should say that. I went to a concert, I went to a basketball game, and it was the NBA in the 02. And sitting in front of me were Little Mix and their boyfriends at the time. This is a few years ago. And I was second row. I had the best seats, honestly, but they were front row. And them and their boyfriends, well, especially their boyfriends or the guys they were with, I don't know if they're boyfriends or not. I don't really know the ins and outs of gossip of Little Mix, but they watched they watched the whole of the basketball game through their mobile phones. And it made me furious. I was so angry that they had these tickets and yet they were filming the whole thing. And then I realized that the reason why I was angry is because I'd walked in there and thought, where's my selfie moment? Where's the bit that I can put on Instagram and Twitter? And I was frustrated by that. So that night I went, right, I'm not going to do it. I'm just not going to say that I'm here. But I broke my contract with the people who got me tickets to go, because they want me to say I'm there, because that's the NBA. What they gave me free tickets. So I was in this real dilemma about what to do. And eventually I said, no, I'm not doing that. And I realized that another stage in my life, I realized I'd been swept up into this thing where every time I go anywhere, I think I need to take a picture of it. I need to get, I need to somehow remember this via a digital thing, which I'll never look at again, or it gains me brownie points. And just to add to this, it's interesting. I interviewed Simon Halfon the other day, who did the documentary about Oasis, Supersonic. Mm. And he said the most astonishing thing about the Nebworth gigs, which that's what it's all about.
Yeah, I was there, weirdly.
Right.
When I was 16.
Well, you will remember, no one had mobile phones and filming it. And it was all you can see is people were actually there experiencing it. And it might be the last event that anybody actually experienced with their own eyes and ears rather than through a phone.
That's so interesting, because, I mean, there's so many things in what you just said. And I've seen that everywhere. But speaking to all these experts and studying their scientific findings, what I learned is there's actually 12 factors that boost or degrade attention. And lots of those 12 are rising and rising and rising throughout, you know, at the moment, and have been rising for several years. And I'll give you an example of one that I think is playing out in that dynamic. There's lots of reasons why in that dynamic at that NBA game, that pisses you off, right? It's people not being present. It's being jolted into sort of thinking egotistically, how do I make other people jealous that I'm here? But also there's a factor in attention that's playing out there that is really important. I went to MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and I interviewed one of the leading neuroscientists in the world, a man named Professor Earl Miller. And he said to me, one of the most important things you've got to understand about the human brain is that you can only ever think about one thing at a time consciously. Right? This is just an absolutely basic human limitation. The human brain has not changed significantly for 40,000 years. It ain't going to change anytime soon. But what's happened is we've convinced ourselves that we can think about many things at the same time. In fact, the average teenager now believes they can follow 7 forms of media at the same time. But what happens when you're trying to do more than one thing at once is your consciousness papers over this. You think you're just doing them all at the same time, but actually you're juggling. You're rapidly switching between lots of different tasks. And so scientists have studied this. They get people in labs and they get them to do lots of things to see what happens to you when you do that. And it turns out there's these 4 quite big effects that take place when you do that. The first is what's called a switch cost effect. So let's say I'm talking to you now. I've deliberately put my phone right at the other side of the room. But if I hadn't, let's say I just glanced at my text messages now, right? And you can imagine I could glance at them for 2 seconds and glance back at you while you were just explaining. You know, you can imagine that's perfectly possible. And I could kid myself, oh, that just took me 2 seconds. But then there's a cost when I'm looking back at you and I'm like, wait, what did Tim just ask me? What's he talking about again? That's called the switch cost effect, right? You've got to reorient your brain again and again. Now imagine I could switch from you to going, oh, I suddenly look at my Facebook updates. So what was that saying? And then I've got the television on in the background. So you're jamming up your brain with this switching, which is a really significant effect. I'll tell you how much in a minute. Even what seems very small has a huge effect. The second is what's called a screw up effect, where basically if I do that, say I'm doing my tax return and I'm also checking my text, I start to make mistakes. And I have to go back and correct my mistakes, right? The third effect is on your memory. To translate your experiences into memories, your brain needs a certain amount of space. And if your brain is jammed up with all this switching, it can't do that. It can't translate things into memories. It's why when you're distracted, you will remember much less of what you experience. And the fourth effect is on your creativity. When your brain is working normally and you have a bit of spare time, your brain will think back over the things it's experienced, things people have said to you, things you've read, and it will combine them in interesting ways, right? That's where creativity comes from, just letting your mind wander and having creative associations. When you're jammed up with switching all the time, that massively is reduced, creativity falls. And these sound like small effects, but it was really striking looking at the science to see actually how big that effect of just a little bit of switching is. There was a study by Hewlett-Packard, the company that make printers, and they got a small study, but they got their workers and split them into 2 groups. One group was told, just do whatever your task is and you're not going to be interrupted. And the second task was told, do your task, but they were interrupted with quite a heavy amount of texting and email, not an insane amount, you know, but a heavy amount. And then their IQ was measured. The people who hadn't been distracted were tested with 10 IQ points higher than the people who were being distracted. To give you a sense of how big that is, if you or me got stoned now, if we just sat together and smoked a spliff, our IQ and attention would diminish by about 5 IQ points. So being distracted is twice as bad for your IQ, at least in the short term, as getting stoned. You'd be better off sitting at your desk, smoking a spliff and doing only one thing at a time than sitting at your desk, not getting stoned and being constantly distracted. There was another study at Carnegie Mellon University where they split the student. They took 138 students and they just split them into 2 groups. And one group was told, do an exam in normal exam conditions. And the other group was told, do the same exam, but you can receive text messages if you want. And you'd expect that second group to do better because they could have easily cheated, right? They could just text someone and ask the answers. In fact, the group that was getting text did on average 20% worse, right? Now we're all losing that 20%, or most of us are losing that 20% of bandwidth by being constantly distracted. So you think about even something like an NBA game, which is very pleasurable to watch. If you're flicking between devices, if you're flicking, you're losing a significant amount of your brain power, right? That process of switching diminishes your ability to follow what's happening, to think about what's happening, to remember what's happening, to think creatively about what you're seeing. It's diminishing your ability to think. And we're really, as Professor Miller put it to me, we live in a perfect storm of cognitive degradation as a result of all this switching and being jammed up. Does that ring true to you, Tim?
Yeah, 100%. You know, when I was a smoker years ago, I've not smoked for 20 years now, but when I smoked years ago, I remember looking at the nicotine on my fingers, you know, the stain you get, and you pretend you're not ever a smoker, aren't you? But you look at your fingers and go, what the hell? And then you start coughing up phlegm. And, you know, at the time, because I was a smoker, my solution to that was wash my hands. You know, I was like, oh, scrub your hands, you know, realizing that. But with this addiction I have, what you talk about the attention thing, but also, it's quite, I find it's quite painful in my life. And I think you articulate this in your book, because I get caught in this sort of rumination, really, of attention. I don't know if that's the right word to do it, but just I get caught in this cycle where I'm like, check, just go back to Twitter, get back to Twitter. And I know I get there. What's on Netflix? What's this? What's that? And eventually I get to the stage, it's sort of, I don't know, 11 o'clock at night, and I'm going, just check some more. And I feel myself doing it. And I think I look at my children, and they can be up to, I mean, they're teenagers and they're off to university now, but when they were living here, they could sometimes be sitting there all through the night because they're just checking one more time. We're addicted, aren't we? It's like one more drink. It's when you're drunk. That's my analogy I always give. Once you have four or five drinks, you might as well have 15, because you just keep going back, going, one more. And then they go closing time and you panic, you're in anxiety. And that is what it seems to create in me. And it must be creating that in a lot of people, and especially our children.
I think you're totally right. And one of the biggest shifts that happened for me when I was interviewing all these experts and learning really deeply about attention and attention problems, it's whereas I think we've been thinking about this deeply wrongly. So when I felt my own attention atrophy, like you're describing, I would criticize myself. I would go into a sort of spiral of feeling ashamed. I'd say, oh, you're weak, you're lazy, you're not strong enough, this is on you. But actually what I learned is, if you look at these 12 causes, our attention didn't collapse. Our attention has been stolen from us. It's been stolen from us by very big forces that go much deeper than just a personal failing or even just one new invention like the smartphone or the internet. There are really deep causes doing this to us. And once you understand those causes, there are things you can do as an isolated individual, but we've also got to take on those forces that are fucking up our attention and fight back against them and restrain them. And there's been lots of examples of that in the past. Think about lead paint and leaded petrol, right? So from the 1920s to the 1970s, lots of people painted their homes with paint that had lead in it, and petrol mostly had lead in it, right? And then it was discovered that lead really destroys people's ability to pay attention, profoundly harms it. It's one of the reasons why there was such a big rise in ADHD. It's one of the reasons why there was actually a big rise in violence, because exposure to lead makes people more violent. So what did we do? We banned lead, right? We banned lead in petrol and we banned lead in paint. And as a result, that aspect of attention, you know, a lot of people, their attention improved. The Center for Disease Control in the US said that that ban alone led to an average of a 5-point IQ increase in American children on average throughout the whole country. Now, there are lots of things that are the equivalent of lead in petrol, right? We've got to deal with those things. We've got to get them out of our environment. And that can sound really big, but there's a huge number of really practical ways we can do that, in addition to lots of things we can do as individuals on our own. And I think we need to think very differently. But the other thing I was thinking, as you were saying that about your kids as well, is even just think about sleep, right? So you're talking about, you know, your kids not sleeping. So on average, so the average child now sleeps 80 minutes less than they did a century ago. And the average adult now sleeps an hour less than they did in 1942. And I interviewed the leading experts in the world on sleep. And even if nothing else had changed, and lots of other things have changed, but even if that was the only change that had happened, that alone would be causing a really big attention crisis. Because sleep is essential for your ability to think clearly and pay attention. There's a amazing expert at Harvard Medical School who I interviewed, Dr. Charles Seisler, who made a whole series of breakthroughs on sleep. But one of the most striking for me was he developed this technique. It was putting together two bits of technology where you put someone into this machine and it tracks what they're looking at with their eyes, and it also tracks what's happening in their brain. And what he discovered is when you're tired, and you don't have to be that tired when you've been awake for 19 hours, what happens is parts of your brain begin to go to sleep. So he discovered this really eerie phenomenon where someone appears to be awake, they're talking, their eyes are open, they look perfectly normal, but literally parts of their brain are asleep, right? It's called local sleep because it's local to one part of the brain. I can say loads about that. But so, yeah, you're pointing at loads of things I think we need to think about deeply.
Yeah, I think the thing we've got to describe at this point is that, and which I like, is it's not our fault. And there's nothing wrong with us, really. I think that's what you're trying to say there, which I love that bit we get to in your book, because we are told constantly we're crap, right? There's so many self-help books out there which are constantly telling you, this is how they made it, this is how they did it, you're not quite good enough. And it's like, oh, I'll get up at 5 o'clock every day if I can become a millionaire. You know, it doesn't work. But on this one, I think what you talk about well in the book is the fact that they're using magic tricks. Even you use that sort of expression there to try and trap us, because the mechanism is the more you watch your screens, the more money they're making. That's the dynamic. That's how it works. And I think a really good example of that, I think, is I keep saying this to my friends. You've all become addicted to Netflix. Right? We all used to sit and watch football. It lasts 90 minutes, bit before, bit afterwards, and then we'd go off and do something else. But Netflix, they keep at the end of every episode, they said they let you watch the next one, don't they? It starts rolling before the titles are finished. But that is your thing on the screen, isn't it? On your phones, on your computer, there's no end to it. So you keep going and going and going.
There's two bits of what you just said that are so important. So the first bit is about the ways in which the sort of self-help industry, or the whole way we talk to and about each other, makes these problems worse. So there's this concept called cruel optimism. It was invented by an American historian called Lauren Berlant. And cruel optimism is where you take something that's got a really big cause in the way we live, like obesity, depression, attention problems. And you say to people, great news, I've got a solution for you. Got attention problems? Just do these two little things every day, meditate for 10 minutes, do the following few things, and all this problem will go away, right? Now, it sounds kind, it sounds optimistic, right? You're saying, you're identifying the person's got a problem, and you're saying you've got power and agency to deal with this. But the problem is, because the solution you offer is so small, sometimes it will work, but for the vast majority of people, it will fail. And then the person will think, well, I did the thing you're meant to do, but it didn't work. There must be something wrong with me. I haven't got the willpower to do it. I haven't got the strength to do it. I'm just broken in some way, right? So it seems kind, but actually ends up whispering to the person, the problem is in you. The problem isn't in the system. The problem is with you. Now, the alternative to cruel optimism isn't pessimism. We don't want people to be pessimistic, and they don't need to be. The solution is authentic optimism, which is where you acknowledge the scale of the problem, you acknowledge the real causes of the problem, and you find ways for all of us together to deal with that. So I'll give you a very simple example, and then I'm really keen to talk about the aspect that you talked about with the internet. So think about we were just talking about switching, and right, the switch cost effect, right? And loads of people listening will identify that. They'll be like, yeah, I do that. I can feel that screws up my attention. And then someone like me, or, you know, kind of more kind of someone in the self-help industry comes along and goes, well, there you go. The solution is stop switching, right? But lots of people, It's incredible, the statistics on this. 35% of people feel they can never unplug because they're constantly waiting for their boss to email them or phone them, and they have to be on call. When you and me were kids, the only people who lived on call were doctors and the prime minister, right? Now, half the economy lives on call. So me coming along going, you know, switching's really bad for you. You might want to sleep more. To them, it will feel like, entirely justifiably, it's like I've gone up to a homeless person and gone, do you know what would make you feel better, mate, would be if you went over there into the Ritz and had a really nice dinner. I think you'd feel better then. And he might go, well, yeah, you fucker. It would. I can't do that, right? So very often, there's lots of things that we don't know are harming our attention that we need to learn about. But very often, there's things that people know harm their attention. And we live in a gap between what people want to do and what they feel they can do. So we have to look at ways we can close that gap. And there are lots of practical ways to do that. And I've seen them in practice. I'll just very quickly give you an example of one, which is in France, they had a big problem with what they called le burnout, which I don't think I need to translate. And it was, a lot of it was being caused by people who felt they could never unplug, right? They're constantly on call. So the French government got a guy called Bruno Mettling, who's the head of Orange, the biggest telecom company, to look into this. And he proposed, and they put into law, a very simple law. It's called the right to disconnect. And the right to disconnect, very simple, just says you by law have a right to have written work hours that are stipulated, and you have a right that outside those work hours, you do not have to respond to emails or work phone calls. So I went to Paris to learn more about this. You know, Rentokil got fined 70,000 euros because they told off one of their workers for not answering an email an hour after, you know, he'd left work, right? So you can see how that frees people. There's no point giving people sweet self-help lectures about the benefits of sleeping more, giving up switching, a lot of the other things we're going to talk about, if you don't also give people practical ways they can actually do that in the world in which we live. You've got to do both. There's individual changes, but together we can fight for these bigger collective changes that make it possible for us to do the individual changes to the degree that we need to. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm reading your book. I loved it. You start off with going on a detox, and actually I remember you tweeting, actually I'll see you in 6 months or something. I was thinking, and I just remember thinking, oh, you lucky bastard, you've actually got control to do that. You can do that. Actually, before I get on to this next point, how do you feel about, I say to my friends all the time, once I get chucked out of TV, which will happen one day, I'm turning it all off because I want to live and I don't want this crap in my mind. But I feel being on TV that it's impossible for me not to be connected today, because I was seeing you or interviewing you. I decided not to look at the news at all. And the anxiety I have for I don't know what time we are now, 1:45 in the afternoon. You know, I've been up since 7. I've not looked at any news and I feel anxious about that. You report this in your findings when you went on detox, didn't you? It's really hard. Could you ever envisage being a journalist like you are, sort of that you could just switch it all off?
No, you're totally right. I just felt at the end of my tether with these problems. So I decided I was going to take 3 months completely off the internet and completely without a smartphone. So I went to this place called Provincetown, which is at the tip of Cape Cod, and I was there for 3 months. And it was really striking to me. I mean, lots of things happened when I was in Provincetown, but you're absolutely right. The way in which we follow the news really induces a sense of panic. I also think, though, the thing you're describing, which is the kind of, the wanky way of putting it would be the dilemma of public figures in an age of distraction, is the truth is, when I tweet, which I do sometimes, I take half the year off, but I do it sometimes, I'm communicating with people, even at the best, even when people are actually want to listen, which most of the time they don't. And even when, you know, all the kind of everything, the wind is behind you and everything is going well, you're communicating with people in an incredibly shallow way. And also through a medium that's designed to make people angry. We'll talk about that, I'm sure, in a minute. Whereas with a book, if I go away and write a book, you know, I spend 3 years researching a book. I learn all these things. And then if someone reads my book, what they're doing is they're engaging really deeply with me and with this journey I've gone on and with the things I've found out. And the difference between a life that consists of loads of very shallow communications, it's like being at a Slipknot concert and shouting at the person next to you, versus a really, I mean, if Twitter is like being at a Slipknot concert and people shouting at you, reading a book is like going on holiday with someone. If someone reads my book, it's going to take them like, I don't know, the medium length reader, maybe 8 hours to read my book, right? That's a long time to spend in my company. So I just think when I get to the end of my life, do I want to have spent my life shouting at people at heavy metal concerts? No disrespect to Slipknot, who I think are quite good. Or do I want to have gone on lots of holidays with people and had really deep, thoughtful conversations with them? And for me, and I totally understand, look, again, there's a bit of cruel optimism in this, because you may well be listening and thinking, well, you know, you fucker, you can do that. I can't, right? And lots of people can't. So I'm interested in thinking about how we can change the culture so more people can do that. But I actually just think a lot of, even for people who are public figures in the way that you are, actually, I think we need to do it, but I don't think we need to do it.
Well, there's one point in the book you make, and I love it, and I think it's only a line, I've written it down here, so I don't know whether I've written it down in my version or your version, but good citizens read the news, and that I find so destructive, because I've felt that for all these years. Oh, I've got to know what's going on in China and wherever, you know, every continent. And I've also got to know what's going on with the left and the right in this country, and what's going on everywhere. I need to know that. Otherwise, I'm not a very good citizen. I need to understand everybody's problems. And yeah, it's not doing me any good at all. I can't do anything about it. You know, what is going on in the news? And yet I'm taking it all on constantly.
Yeah, that line was said to me by a professor in Denmark, and he was warning about something that I think comes back to what you were asking about the internet before, which is a difference between learning about the news and choosing to take action in sensible ways, which we all can do. And there are things we can all do to affect the trends that are happening around us. I mean, we can each make a small contribution, but together we can do really big things. But I think you've got to understand the difference. And I know you're sensitive to this and have been for a long time, Tim. The difference between absorbing those things in one set of mediums versus another, like Facebook or Twitter. And to understand that, it comes back to what you were saying before about the ways in which these sites are designed. So I went to interview a lot of Silicon Valley dissidents, people who've been involved in designing the world in which we now live, and regret it in all sorts of complicated ways. And one of them, Tristan Harris, amazing guy, is former design ethicist at Google until he quit because he realized they weren't interested in ethics. There's no point being the ethicist. He said to me, it was a moment, it was just kind of, I interviewed him loads of times, but it was one moment where I thought, oh, this is beginning to fall into place for me. So he said to me, if you open Facebook now, it'll tell you loads of things. It'll tell you, you know, your cousin just tagged you in a photo. It'll tell you, this is what you said 5 years ago. It'll tell you it's your nan's birthday, whatever it might be. There isn't a button that says, I'd like to meet up with people or any of my friends around nearby and want to meet up, right? Now you'd think a lot of people have looked at Facebook and thought, oh, I wonder who's available now. That would be a really popular button. Pretty much everyone listening to this on Facebook can think of a time they would have liked to have had that button. So why doesn't the market provide it? Why doesn't Facebook give us that button? To understand, I think if you follow the trail from that, you begin to understand what some of the ways in which our attention is being destroyed. So when you open Facebook, it makes money in two ways. Obviously, if you open Facebook and scroll through it, you'll start to see advertising. And obviously, the advertisers pay to be there. That's a very clear way that we're all aware of. The second method is much more important. Everything you say and do on Facebook is observed, scanned, and sorted by Facebook. So if you say you like Kylie Minogue, Donald Trump, and you know, you message your mum, and actually the Kylie Donald Trump Venn diagram may not be that big now I think of it. and you like, you know, and you message your mum saying, oh, I've just bought some nappies, then okay, it knows you like Kylie, you like Trump, and you've got a young child. Imagine thousands of data points like that. It's building up a complex profile of you as a person. And the reason it does that is to sell that information to advertisers so they can target you. So when you use Facebook, it's free because you are the product. They then sell you to advertisers. That's the whole model. Once you understand that, you begin to see why there's no button that says, let's meet up. Because the minute you shut the app, the minute you put your phone down, they start to lose money. They're not getting money from the advertising, and they're not getting the data on you to sell. If the button said, which of my mates are around and want to meet up, you would go and see Joe. You go, oh, Joe wants to have a pint. I'll go and see Joe in the pub, right? You wouldn't be interacting through Facebook. You'd be actually looking at each other face to face, assuming not in plague times, right? That's a disaster for Facebook if you do that. Every time you put the phone down, they lose money. And every time you keep scrolling, they make money. So all of their engineers, everything they do is designed to keep you scrolling. So you have some of the cleverest people in the world developing highly sophisticated techniques, all of which are designed specifically around invading your attention. And they're very explicit about that. Sean Parker was one of the first investors in Facebook, a hugely influential figure in the history of Facebook, said, we consciously designed it to figure out how to take as much of your attention as possible. We knew what we were doing and we did it anyway.
Yeah, there's that guy, I can't remember it, The Endless Scroll. What's it called?
Aza Raskin, yeah.
What's this scroll called? And you'll know it when you see it, because in the old days of the internet, you got to the end of the page and it said, do you want to go to the next page? Now it just keeps scrolling and scrolling and scrolling, and he's not happy about it, is he?
Well, it's so fascinating. So Aza is a really interesting person. Aza's dad, Jeff Raskin, was the guy who designed the Apple Macintosh. So a hugely important figure in the history of tech. And Aza was this sort of prodigy child. I think he gave his first like lecture on coding when he was 10 or something. And when he was in his early 20s, he invented exactly that technique. So people will remember, and some websites still work this way. It used to be when you got to the bottom of a page, you know, there'd be like 10 Facebook status updates, and you'd have to click a 2 at the bottom to go to the next set. And then you have to click to another one and another one. And what that did is it just gave you a moment to pause and go, do I want to carry on looking at this? Or do I want to do something else, right? And Aza invented something at the time he thought was really helpful, which is, it's called infinite scroll. And it's very simple. Now, when you get to the bottom of the page for something like Facebook, it'll just automatically load the next thing, right? And it's called infinite because it will just keep going on forever, right? You just get to the bottom and it'll load you more and more. You can never get to the bottom of it. And Aza had this moment. I mean, his own attention was being wrecked by lots of techniques like this. And he had this moment where he just sat down one day and figured out, okay, how much longer, because there's good evidence, infinite scroll makes people scroll longer. You don't get that moment of being interrupted and going, do I want to carry on doing this? So he figured out, how much extra human time have I taken with my invention? And he figured out, every day, the equivalent of 200,000 human lives, entire lives, so every week, is taken up just with people scrolling more as a result of infinite scroll. And he's like, what have I done? And there's dozens of techniques like that. But Aza is at the real forefront of arguing for change. And what he argues, and lots of other people who know this industry really well argue, is the most important thing for us to understand is it doesn't have to work this way. You can have social media. At the moment, we have social media that is maximally designed to hack your attention and destroy it and keep you scrolling. But social media doesn't have to work that way. You think again about what we're saying about lead paint. I'm in a room that's painted. You're in a room that's painted. We still paint things. We just don't use lead paint. In the same way, we can change the business model. So what Aza says is we should, and it sounds quite stark when you hear it, but then you follow the logic. Aza says we should just ban that business model, a business model that tracks you, surveils you in order to package you and sell your attention to the highest bidder. The way he puts it is that it's just anti-human and it's got to go, right? So you think, I said to him, well, and a lot of the other people, well, what happens? Okay, let's say we did that, we ban it. What happens the next day when I open Facebook or Twitter? And they said, okay, what would happen is those companies wouldn't vanish. They would have to find a different business model. And there are business models that everyone listening already has lots of experience with that are entirely, you know, that they could adopt easily. One, you mentioned Netflix. One could be a subscription model, right? We'd all pay 50 cents a month or whatever to be on Facebook. Or there's a model, everyone listening is somewhere near a sewer, right? Obviously, it used to be there were no sewers. We got cholera, all sorts of problems. So together, we built sewers. And we own those sewers together because we all have an interest in not getting cholera and not, you know, having shit in the streets, right? We all own those sewers together. Maybe we want to say, just like we own the sewage pipes, maybe we want to own the information pipes together because we're getting the informational and attentional equivalent of cholera. There's all sorts of different models that we could try, ones which are already in practice. The really important thing about that is that once you move to a different business model, a whole different set of potentials open up. It's no longer designed to raid and sell your attention. It can actually be designed to help you heal your attention. That button, for example, the which of my friends are around, that would be one of the first things to appear, but there would be loads of other things like that.
I think there's a big point you make in your book that model is in existence because that is how we judge success in the world is economic growth. And so you've got that situation in every government at the moment is they're just trying to make as much money as they possibly can. And then you've got this ridiculous scenario now where you've got Zuckerberg and Elon Musk and everyone who are just playing the game. Let's see how much money they can collect. Bill Gates offsets his collecting money nonsense by he doesn't give it back to the customer or his employees. He gives it to charity. So he plays God by curing malaria or whatever. And it's like, hold on, who said he could have all the world's money to cure malaria? And are you sure that's the priority? Well, you know, I'm not saying it isn't, by the way, before people get angry with me, but surely are we sure they're the priorities, in the world? Why are they deciding? And so we need to really rethink globalization and what we've come to. And this is a terrible reflection of what the world is like anyway. And the bit that if you think, oh, we'll just switch it off, stop scrolling, stop doing that, the bit you haven't mentioned yet is they engage with you in a very dark way because they as humans, we want news and we want to scroll and we want things because it's a survival mechanism. We need to know the bad news rather than the good news. The bad news keeps you alive. The good news doesn't keep you alive. That's what happens. You need to know where the snake is so you don't get pinned by the snake. And so that's what they play into, isn't it? And so that is where it's their angle. So it's not healthy for the world.
No, you're totally right. I think you put it really well. And there's a whole range of ways in which this current business model and the way it's designed social media fucks with your... I can swear, can't I, by the way?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Fucks with your... I'm too sweary. My mother's Glaswegian. I'm too sweary generally. But the ways in which this fucks with your attention. So one is, and you alluded to this before, Tim, it makes you crave the reward system it sets up, right? So... you know, your guys at your NBA match, why are they doing that? Partly it's because they want people to see they're there and get a flood of likes and hearts and OMG, I'm so jealous, right? So it makes us crave those reward systems. It makes us switch tasks more. We talked about that. It learns specifically how to raid your attention. So what it does is it learns your patterns. So for me, for example, the perfect way to raid my attention is to show me, you know, a clip of Noam Chomsky, a hot shirtless man, another clip of Noam Chomsky, right? Then two hot shirtless men, right? But for you, I'm pretty sure that's going to be a different thing that's going to be the thing that distracts you, but it learns your patterns of distraction. But the most important one, or the most disturbing one, I think, is exactly the one you've gone to, which is about anger. So what the algorithm, the machinery that decides what to show you next on Facebook, that algorithm has one goal, only one goal, keep you scrolling, right? That's its sole purpose. And what those algorithms learned is if you want to keep people scrolling, and this wasn't the intention of anyone at Facebook, it was something that the algorithm picked up, is people will pay attention more and longer to things that make them angry than to things that make them feel good. And we've all had that experience. You're driving on the motorway, you pass a car crash, you stare at the car crash a lot longer than you stare at the pretty flowers on the other side of the road, right? And you're absolutely right. The reason is a kind of simple evolution, probably a simple evolutionary reason, which is the people who, our ancestors who were vigilant to danger and stared at the potential risk longer, they're the ones who got to be our ancestors because the ones that just stared at the pretty flowers got eaten, right? That's a slightly simplistic way of putting it, but you get my point. This is called negativity bias. There's a lot of evidence for it. Even 10-week-old babies will stare longer at an angry face than at a smiling face.
Wow.
Because, you know, they're trying to pick up on danger. They're trying to pick up on risk. But that has a horrific effect on the internet because if you use these business models, because what that means is the Pew Research Center did a study that showed the more words of anger and rage you put into your Facebook status updates. So if you put anger and rage in, it will double your likes and shares, right?
I've got some of the words here from your book, because I took a picture of the book, and now every time I'm tweeting, I'm trying to use these words to see what. So this is from YouTube. The words they like is hates, obliterates, slams, destroys, and then other words you've got a little word further down is attack, bad, and blame. And they're words that go really well, you know, that work well if you're trying to get some likes and or get some interaction, I suppose.
Exactly, because the algorithm will select for angry messages to promote because they'll engage people more, and engaged people keep scrolling. Mm. If it's enraging, it's engaging, right? Mm. Now, that has a catastrophic effect. It has a catastrophic effect at an individual level. Imagine your teenagers. I was speaking to a teenager about this yesterday. Two teenagers go to a party. One of them goes home and says on Facebook or Snapchat, that was a really nice party. I liked everyone there. They all looked great. Another teenager goes home and goes, what a shit party. Caroline looked like an absolute slag. She was trying to pull my boyfriend and Bob looked like an ugly pig, right? The algorithm will select to promote the second person's messages to far more people than the first person's messages. Because if it's enraging, it's engaging, it will keep people scrolling, more people are more likely to react. We're more vigilant to nastiness than we are to kindness. If you see a nice message, you're more likely to put the phone down. If you see a nasty message, you're not. Now, we can see how that makes people feel like shit. It's obvious, you don't need me to explain that. But we're also seeing that at a huge political level, right? It's not a coincidence, I think, that there's many things going on. This is certainly not the only factor. But that if you create a machinery into which we are all plugged for about an hour a day that is designed to make people angry, that and also promotes untrue things ahead of true things, and there's a study by MIT that showed that, that anger doesn't vanish when we put the phone down, right? That anger becomes supercharged, and we're seeing that all over the world. So I think we've got to deal with, there's two kinds of attention, isn't there? I mean, there's many kinds, but there's two ways of thinking about attention. One is this individual attention, right? Your individual ability to do things. But there's also your collective attention. There's our ability as a society to pay attention to things together. And that is being absolutely destroyed at the moment. Think about something as simple as, you'll remember, but younger listeners won't, the ozone layer crisis, right? So in the 1980s, it was discovered, we didn't know it, but then we knew it, that in hairsprays and in fridges, there was something called CFCs, that was destroying the ozone layer, which is a layer around the planet that protects us from the heat of the sun's rays. And it was causing a hole in the ozone layer above the Arctic, and it was actually had the potential to melt the Arctic. And I remember being absolutely fucking terrified as like a seven-year-old of the ozone layer crisis. And what happened? Ordinary people heard the science. They could distinguish the science from lies. They pressured their politicians to act. And they kept that pressure up on their politicians until CFCs were banned. And now the hole in the ozone layer is healing. It will be healed fairly soon, right? So that was an amazing example of collective attention, right? We individually paid attention and together we paid attention. If the ozone layer crisis happened today, I really don't think that would happen. Firstly, I think a load of bullshit. I mean, the internet would be flooded with people saying the ozone layer doesn't exist. The hole in the ozone layer is caused by George Soros and Jewish people and just insane racist nonsense. We would tribalize around it. You'd get one group of people who'd, you know, adopt some symbol that was about the ozone layer, and you'd get another group of people who would take photos of themselves spraying hairspray at the sky going, fuck the ozone layer. We would just, and we wouldn't, our collective capacity for attention has been absolutely trashed.
Do you know what? It's funny because the example that was used on that documentary, I can't remember the name of it now, you'd probably know, is I think it was the documentary where they said women who've given birth obviously go online and they look at stuff to do with children, and then they're fed anti-vax stuff because they know it rates well. And you're paranoid when you're a parent because you don't want your child to die, and it gets you at your weakest. But it's not because there's some horrible menace out there. Well, there is the person who makes the videos. But what it is they're just trying to get you to stay online. So it's exactly the point you're making. I wonder actually, Johan, whether we're doing this in December and I'm going to put this out in January. So this actually happened yesterday, but Jack Dorsey is resigning from Twitter. Now, if I want to start my own conspiracy theory, I wonder if Jack has thought, I'm out of this because he can see what's happening. And we seem to be very good now at prosecuting people for their past acts. I wonder if these guys like Zuckerberg and Jack Dorsey and stuff like that, they're going to be held up and we're going to be going, hold on, guys, you need to do some prison time for what you created here, right? You know, I'm maybe jumping forward a bit, but why is Jack giving up? I've just read your book, so I started going, hold on, he's getting out of here because he knows we're all going to turn on it sooner or later.
You know, the funny thing about these people, I know people who know them, is they're not evil, right? They're any more than, you know, the head of KFC is evil, right? They've just got a business model, and always the temptation, and I feel that temptation as well, is to look for the devil who did it to us, right? But the truth is, these are just people operating in systems. They're quite banal people. They're not interesting people. They're not even particularly intelligent, actually, when you meet a lot of these Silicon Valley people who think they're the masters of the universe. I'm not talking about the brilliant dissidents that I met who are really impressive. The temptation is to see it as, just like the temptation is to see it as a personal flaw in you, then when you discover these systemic things, the temptation is to go, oh, it's a personal flaw in them. But the truth is, we've just got to regulate these systems. This is obviously only one of the 12 causes that we're talking about, but that we've got to deal with the systems themselves. And the truth is, you know, these are, I believe they're doing terrible harm to the world. But also, we've got to be honest, we're letting them do it, right? We allow them to do this. As a society, we can regulate these companies. They'll fight like hell against it. But we can regulate these companies and stop them doing these things if we choose to. And at the end of the day, once we know what they're doing to us, and once we're aware of it, we have to assume a degree of responsibility, you know, and we have to change how we think. We are not medieval peasants sitting at the court of King Zuckerberg begging for crumbs of attention from his table. We are the free citizens of democracies, and we can take back our minds if we want to, and we can take on these forces that are stealing our focus, but we have to decide to do it. We have to understand where we are, and we have to decide to do it.
Yeah. And I think we've got to say, by the way, that the internet, there's some real good stuff about it. And being connected, there's some really good stuff.
Oh, there's amazing things about it. And that's the really important thing. We can have a lot of the good things without these harmful things. Now, there's always going to be some element of greater distraction as a result of smartphones. But we can have systems of social media that are designed to heal your attention, not hack your attention. Those things are perfectly technologically easy to design. It's a question of changing the business model. And I remember that's even good for them. One of the people I interviewed was this guy called Dr. James Williams, an amazing guy who used to be a Google engineer and now is a professor at the University of Oxford. And I remember when James was still a designer, one day he sat in this tech conference with loads of people who were designing social media. And he said to them, could you put up your hand if you want to live in the world that you're designing? And nobody put up their hand.
Wow.
These people are being hacked just like we are. I mean, there's this chilling moment Tristan Harris told me about. So he worked on the Gmail team when they were developing Gmail. And there was this moment where they had to increase their user base. And there was a moment and get the people who were using it to use it longer and more often. This moment where one of his colleagues just said, oh, I've got an idea. Why don't we make it so that every time someone gets an email, their phone vibrates? And everyone said, oh, that's a good idea. And a couple of weeks later, Tristan was walking around San Francisco and he just hears all these vibrations and just realizes that was happening all over the world. He actually figured out that his team was responsible for 11 billion interruptions to people every day, right? Just a result of his colleague going, oh, that's a good idea, right? And the incentive structure for those colleagues. So it's better for them. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg will have less money. All right. He'll be merely one of the 50 richest people in the history of the human race, not one of the top 10. All right. He'll survive. You know, I want to send him to prison. I just want to, I don't even want to take away all his money. Right. I mean, I think he should be taxed, but we can have a conversation about that another time. But it genuinely is in the interest of everyone. They may not know it's in their interests, these very rich people, but at some level, it can't be spiritually good for them to know that they're supercharging hatred and racism and all sorts of things.
So your campaign really would be, if I'm going to put you in charge, I am going to put you in charge of the campaign, whether you like it or not. Your campaign is going to be ban surveillance capitalism.
That very specific model of invading, of tracking people in order to figure out how to maximally invade their attention and then selling that data to advertisers so they can do it. Yeah, I think we should ban that model. That's one of a series of demands, I think. some of which are not related to tech at all, which I think would provably improve our ability to focus and pay attention. I think there's good evidence for that. And I think it's really achievable. You know, I mean, it's a big fight, but we're all the beneficiaries of big fights. You know, I mean, I'm gay. And for 2,000 years, gay people were imprisoned, burned, killed. And then a group of gay people banded together and said, you know what? We're just like you and we don't want to be treated like this anymore. And loads of people opened their hearts and changed. And now we still have some work to do, but we have overwhelmingly equality for gay people, right? Happened. It was one way for 2,000 years and then it happened really quickly. James Williams, the guy I was just talking about, said to me once, you know, the axe existed for 1.4 million years before anyone thought to put a handle on it. The internet has existed. The internet has existed for less than 10,000 days, right? Yeah. We can change these things if we want to.
Can I say that the book, Johan's book, is so worth reading because you learn so much about how your brain works as well via a myriad of experts. One of the great bits in it, which I absolutely loved, is when I started trying to meditate years ago, and I meditate a lot now, but it took me years to actually understand what I was doing. But one of the great ways of meditating is just to daydream. And I know you now go for a walk, an hour's walk every day, just to let your mind wander. And it occurred to me, and this all occurred to me when my children started going to school, they were constantly told to sit down at a desk. And then what they were doing is they were told to concentrate, constantly concentrate. And every now and then you'd go and see a teacher and they'd say, they just don't concentrate in class. And then when you leave school and you become an adult, you're told that you have to do yoga because you spent so much of your life sitting down. and then you're told mindfulness because you can't daydream anymore because your brain is totally concentrated. The point you make in your book is daydreaming is such a beautiful thing for the brain to do, to actually do nothing. Yet the anxiety you get by going, hold on, I've got an hour to just walk, like you say, without a phone or do something like that. You go, no, I could be doing this instead, is where you always get to, isn't it? With the thought, I mean, I don't anymore because I'm desperately trying to break my addiction, but that's how I normally feel.
You're so right. This is one of the things that I found. One thing that was most unexpected for me in those 3 months that I went away. So there's this, when we think about attention, there's been one metaphor that's really dominated how people think about attention for 100 years, right? So if you picture the Hollywood Bowl or the O2 or something, and you picture everyone coming in and there's loads of noise and bustle and everything, and then Adele or whoever it is walks on stage and everyone goes quiet and there's a spotlight on Adele. That is our dominant metaphor for attention. We think of attention as the spotlight. Attention is usually defined as, they say, your ability to selectively attend to things in the environment. So it's your ability to shut out everything else and focus on this one thing. And when I went away to heal my attention, I thought, oh, okay, this is great. What I'm going to be able to do is I'm going to be able to deploy my spotlight more. I'll be able to sit in one place and read a book for like 8 hours. And then I'll be able to listen to this long podcast because I brought my iPod with me, not my phone. And then I'll be able to have long conversations. So I was thinking, oh, it's all going to be about the spotlight, right? And that did in fact happen. My spotlight did massively improve with some ups and downs along the way. But then there was something that happened that I didn't expect and was actually even more kind of fertile for me, which is one day I decided to remember it really clearly. I just, in Provincetown, there's this really, well, the beach is the whole of the Cape, so you could just walk around the whole Cape if you had the time, but I would just go for these really long walks on the beach, like 5 hours, and I started, for the first month or so, I would always take an audiobook with me, and I was listening to it on my iPod. Funny, every time I turned on my headphones, I've got these noise-canceling headphones, and they would always say, searching for Johan's iPhone, searching for Johan's iPhone, and then it would go, the iPhone cannot be found. And I would always be like, oh shit. But so I go for these really long walks. And then I started just leaving the iPod at home and just walking and just thinking and letting my mind just float. I was walking on the beach and it was floating like the waves were floating. And the first a good week or so that I did this, I kept thinking, this isn't what you came here for, right? This isn't right. You came here to focus. Why are you doing this? But then I actually, obviously later, I interviewed the leading experts in the world about mind wandering. And it was so interesting. It's this amazing guy called Professor Marcus Reichel, who is an amazing neuroscientist at the Washington School of Medicine in St. Louis in Missouri. And he made a whole series of breakthroughs about this. It's funny because he used to get told off at school for mind wandering and daydreaming, right? His teacher, Mr. Smith, used to always say that to him, calling his parents and say, "Oh, your son, he's got this problem. He always daydreams." And then years later, he makes these huge breakthroughs in daydreaming where he discovered that when we think we're not thinking about anything, when we're mind wandering, in fact, your brain is just as active as when you're in spotlight focus. It's just thinking about different things. And so it's been discovered, there's lots of academics who've looked into this since, and they discovered that when you're mind wandering, you're actually doing three really important things. Firstly, you're making sense of everything you've experienced. So if you think about when you read a book, or the people listening to this podcast, right? At one level, they've got a spotlight focus. They're listening to your words and my words. But also in the pauses, in the breaks after this, they're going to think, "Oh, that reminds me a bit of when I was a kid and this happened," or "Does that really match with this other thing that I know? Is he right?" They're going to ruminate on it. They'll let their mind wander a bit on it. That's how we make sense of things. If you don't have the space to kind of go, "Oh yeah, this is like that, and that's like that, and it connects to this, and oh, is that right? And what about this?" That mind wandering is making sense of the world. That's not a distraction from making sense. That is making sense. The other thing we do in mind wandering is we make connections between things we otherwise didn't see connections between. And the third is, and this is really important for feeling good about yourself, when you mind wander, you think about what's going to happen in the future. You begin to create a picture of the future. And these are all really important things. Marcus Reichel, the guy who made a breakthrough on this, remember when I interviewed him, he had just turned 80. And for years, he'd played in a symphony orchestra. He'd just given it up because of his age. And I remember him saying to me, "You know, thinking is like a symphony orchestra. You need your oboes and your woodwinds. You need all the different kinds of instrument to play, you know, Dvorak's Ninth Symphony or whatever it is. But what we have now," and this is I'm going further than his metaphor. I don't think he would approve of this metaphor, or I don't think it would be his metaphor. But what we've got now is we're in this disastrous situation where we're neither focusing in a spotlight way, nor are we mind wandering. We're just sort of switching and jammed up and anxious. And the metaphor I'd make is it's like we've got a symphony orchestra, but the stage has been raided by a heavy metal band who are biting off the heads of bats and spitting it at the audience. And actually we've lost all the ability to hear the sound, right? Not to say that heavy metal music isn't a legitimate form of sound, but you know what I mean? So we need to create this space for mind wandering. Mind wandering is an essential form of focus. It's a focus on making sense. It's a focus on making connections. And it's a focus on thinking about the future and creating a picture of the future. And we've really profoundly lost that. And that's one of the things I took away from this period where I was off the internet, was just, I've really got to build this into my life. But you know, there's also something.
And the other thing about mind wandering is that, you know, if you spend all your time watching Netflix and stuff, it's exciting, but the stuff which can go on in your mind is, if you let it ride, is up there. Your mind is amazing if you let it just, you know, like your dreams are amazing. You can do that in the daytime too if you let yourself daydream a lot. Johan, we've run out of time, but just finally, very quickly, because I'll try and keep these an hour and we're way over, but have you healed yourself?
No. Because that's the thing, isn't it? Normal self-help books, I don't think of mine as a self-help book. I don't get offended people call it that.
Yours is not a self-help book. Yours is just absolute knowledge and fantastic knowledge. And you've got to read this book. If you're a parent, you've got to read this book as well, because there's so much about children in here as well, which we haven't even touched on. Sadly, we've run out of time. It's a brilliant book.
I haven't healed myself because, for a few reasons, you know, the structure of self-help books is always, "Dear reader, I had this problem. I did this. Now you can do it too, and your problem will be solved." But the truth is, I haven't solved the problem for myself, and I've made it a bit better, right? I would say I did lots of personal interventions and tweaks and changes, and I recommend them in the book. And I think they've improved my attention by about 15 to 20% on a good day, which is a lot, right? It really has helped me. But I remember when I came back from Provincetown, James Williams, that former Google engineer, I went to go and see him in Moscow. And he said to me, "What you did, a digital detox, is not the solution to these problems, for the same reason that wearing a gas mask is not the solution to air pollution," right? Gas mask might help you. I'm not against people wearing a gas mask, but that's not the solution. We've got to go to the thing that's causing these problems, and we've got to deal with those causes. And at the moment, we're sort of in a position where we're being constantly covered with itching powder. And then the people pouring itching powder on us are going, you know, you might want to learn to meditate and then you wouldn't scratch so much, right? It's like, all right, yeah, I mean, I agree. I'm in favor of meditation, but you should stop pouring itching powder on me, you fucker, right? And I think we're in a similar situation, right? So we've got to do both. We've got to do the individual stuff. It's important. I'm strongly in favor of it. I talk about what it is in the book, but we've also got to stop these fuckers doing this to us. We've got to go to the people who are stealing our focus and reclaim it. And there are very practical ways we can do that.
And surveillance capitalism. Johan's our leader. Thank you so much for...
I decline the leadership. Another Messiah.
Got it. Whether you like it or not, you've got it. Thank you so much for joining me today. Always a pleasure. Your book, cheers, Stolen Focus, is fantastic. And I meant to say,
my publishers will tase me. Well, first, I want to say thank you so much for engaging so deeply with the book, Tim. It's always such a joy to talk to you. You've got such an intelligent engagement in these things. And it's such a pleasure to... You know, when you write a book, it's like putting a message in a bottle and throwing it into the ocean. And I feel talking to you, it's like, oh, someone found my bottle. That's really nice. So I meant to say, anyone who wants any more information about the book, where they can get the audio book, the ebook, or the physical book, can go to stolenfocusbook.com. I meant to read out this stupid blurb, which says, if you'd like to know what Stephen Fry, Hillary Clinton, and lots of other famous people said about the book, but I can't do that. Also, you can listen for free to audio of lots of the experts we've talked about. You can read clips about them talking about these various things. So it's stolenfocusbook.com.
Well, you can put on the book. Tim Lovejoy says it's great. So there you go. Very important book for me anyway. I loved it. Thank you so much, Johan.
Thank you, Tim. What a joy. Thank you so much. Cheers.